Hi, it's Colleen O'Brien for Sharp Vision Modern LASIK. I can't believe I waited so long to have LASIK. 2018 is your year for LASIK. Don't wait another year. For a limited time, receive $1,000 off your LASIK procedure. Go online to schedule your free consultation.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Heather Bosch, who's in for Colleen this week. I saw a piece in Crosscut which quoted a homelessness expert as saying the solutions to combat homelessness aren't complicated. And I said, I have to talk to this person. And here she is, Sarah Rankin, who is director of the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project at Seattle U School of Law. Seattle University, for people who don't know, has basically taken on homelessness as a university-wide issue. They have all the disciplines involved, and you're one of them. So when you said that the solutions aren't complicated, what did you mean? Because it strikes me they're very complicated, because if not, we'd have solved it by now.
They're not complicated. We know what solves homelessness, and it's homes, right? It's a simple equation. But the process of getting the political will and a coherent strategy for implementing the solutions is where we get tripped up. And our project focuses in particular on something called criminalization. It's a fancy word that basically means that our laws, as they exist right now, actually create homelessness and maintain homelessness.
Created how?
They create it because there's a series of laws that punish visibly poor people or people who have no alternative but to live in public. For conducting necessary life-sustaining activities, so survival activities. Things like sitting, standing, sleeping, asking for help, eating, all of these sorts of things are the things that you and I can't forego for very long and still survive. But the way that our laws operate ensure that people who do those things in public, who appear to be poor, will be pulled into the criminal justice system.
But the reason for that is it's perceived that those people are refusing to take advantage of the considerable number of programs that are out there to help them.
Well, it's interesting you say that. Two points. One is the way that our laws work render a lot of these people ineligible to take advantage of those services. And I can explain that a little bit.
Yeah.
When you're hit with any of these laws, when you're accused of violating these laws, you can either get a ticket or you can be hit with a misdemeanor. It depends on the law. But even if you get a ticket, if you can't comply with the conditions, which often include things like fees and fines that you cannot pay, that ticket can evolve into a misdemeanor. Once you are saddled with a misdemeanor, then you become ineligible to take advantage of a number of different programs and benefits, including many shelters, which have barriers to people who have that sort of history.
But I thought the whole reason we shifted to this navigation team system, where they go out, they try to find out what your problem is, what you need, and then get you help, was that judges, instead of imposing fines, which, as you point out, create this this circle of poverty, because they're already poor, can't pay the fine, it gets worse and worse, instead say, go to this program. Don't they do that?
No, they don't do that. First off, we know that people are still being hit very heavily with fines and fees. There was an article recently for a guy who got hit with a $1,250 ticket for camping in Seattle. So we know that those fines are still being assessed. Mm. The Navigation Center is a great idea in theory. It's a low-barrier shelter, right, so that people who have all of the criminal history that we're talking about, or have pets or want to stay with their spouses, there's a number of different things, and we should talk about that a little bit more in a minute, all of the different obstacles that make shelters functionally inaccessible for people. So the problem with the Navigation Center is that there's no place to send these people to. The idea is they're supposed to be coming into the Navigation Center and navigating to permanent housing.
Right.
But the permanent housing doesn't exist, so it's a supply problem on the other end of the chain. So the people who are coming through, there's so few places for them to go.
But the Union Gospel Mission has come here a couple of times and told us, we have a place for anybody who needs a place to sleep.
So, yes, they will say that. But when it comes right down to it, first off, we don't have sufficient beds for the number of people that we have that are experiencing homelessness. But even assuming that we did, like I said, there's many barriers to shelter that make them functionally inaccessible. I'll give you an example. My son and I have a 15-year-old son. In most circumstances, he and I would have to split up in order for us to avail ourselves of a shelter. I'm obviously not going to do that. I'm not going to leave my son. For other people, they're unwilling to leave a spouse or a partner, a pet. They have to give up their personal belongings, you know, get rid of them or find a place to put them. Some people, especially, we have a strong number, a very large number of LGBTQ youth who are in disproportionately represented in homeless populations. They don't
because they are rejected by their families?
Quite frequently, that's the case. So a very large disproportionate number of youth who are homeless, experiencing homelessness, identify as LGBTQ. For those youth, going to a place that requires you to recite prayers or have some religious service, participate in religious services, is so uncomfortable that it's not some place that they're going to go. They'd rather be someplace where they can be themselves.
I suppose if they're rejected by their families for religious reasons, which I guess happens in some cases, that's the last place they want to end up.
Right. So we expect people to give up all these things, right? Your family, your pets, your possessions, your identity, your sense of self, in exchange for one night in a shelter, and then you just get kicked back out the next day without any of those things. It's an unrealistic
proposal. So camping becomes a reasonable solution for that.
I think it does.
For them.
It does. And for many people, too, you have to understand, they have had offers of shelter and service before. We don't have a perfect solution. There's no real-time communication about where shelter beds might be available. So even if an offer of shelter is made, we don't have a good system for making sure that even if that person wanted to avail themselves of that shelter, that they could get there and that there would be a fit between that person and what that shelter could offer.
What do other cities do then? Because Barb Poppy, the city's homelessness consultant, who's from, I think, Columbus, Ohio, says that they don't see the same levels of homeless families. She was particularly concerned about the number of children who are living in these tents. She says that Seattle's the only city she knows of where you see as many homeless children as we have here. Is that true? And if it is, why?
We do have an extraordinary number of homeless children. It's important for people to understand that at least nationwide, homeless women and children represent about 40% of the homeless population. The number one contributor to homelessness for single female-headed families is domestic violence. So about 92% of women who are single, the head of a family, have identified domestic violence as a contributor to their homelessness. And about 60% of those who have been surveyed say that they've experienced that sort of a history of sexual trauma or abuse from that started before they were 12. So what we're talking about here is extensive trauma. Repeated trauma, and it manifests itself in homelessness. There's programs. We have a fabulous a program called Mary's Place. Partly at Amazon, yes. And it would be fabulous to be able to bring those things to scale. They turn away families all the time. They just don't have sufficient space. They don't have sufficient facilities to keep as many homeless families in shelter as they should. And I have to point this out too, Dave. Washington State is the second to worst state in the entire country for treating mental illness.
Why?
Oh, gosh, I wish I knew the answer to that. A lot of it has to do with divesting from progressive and proven mental health treatment programs. But we underinvest in mental health treatment. That is a huge contributor. You know, to be one of the worst states in the nation for dealing with mental illness, it's part of the equation.
It sounds to me then like the approach we're taking, which is to try and build more housing, is not alone going to be sufficient.
Building more housing will help, It will certainly help. We have a lot of new homeless people who, you know, really are just at the brink because of the way that rents are rising. But we also need to look at bringing housing first programs to scale. That is a proven intervention, especially for people who need other services like mental health treatment or substance abuse treatment.
So housing first, does that mean just an apartment, or are we talking about some sort of, I guess what I would call assisted living, where you have an apartment that's got services attached to it, which gets pretty expensive?
Well, actually, it's interesting you say that. Yes, that is one way of describing a housing first program. Traditionally, the way that we've thought of homelessness is that in order for you to deserve housing or services, you have to prove yourself as worthy, right? You have to fix yourself first, and then you'll get housing. What we know from experiments that have been done across the country, and especially well in a number of different cities, is that if you give someone housing first and don't require them to partake in those services, they eventually, through that stability, start to partake in those services and have better outcomes, lower rates of recidivism in terms of homelessness and any other issues. So Housing First has proven itself not just to be effective in terms of the interventions it makes in people's lives, but it's also more cost effective. So you mentioned that it sounds expensive. There are a number of studies that show, including one that looked at a Housing First program here in Seattle, that show that those sorts of investments are more effective and less costly than not doing it. Because people experiencing homelessness not only generate enormous costs because we house them through our criminal justice system, but they also generate, they're the highest users of emergency response. So if you look at medical and the justice system alone, those costs by not addressing homelessness far outweigh, in the millions, far outweigh the
cost of
providing.
Information? Is this a brand new concept?
No.
Because then why is it taking so long? I mean, the latest program I heard talked about creating maybe 5,000 units over 10 years. They need 5,000 units right now.
Yeah, we need 10,000 units.
All right,
they need
10,000 units right now. But I mean, but the units that they build, like the ones out at I forget what it was, Sam Point or something, was something like $250,000 each. There's not enough money to fix it that way.
So part of the problem is that we know, like I said, we started this session today talking about the solution not being complicated. We know that housing solves homelessness. How you define housing and how you approach housing is going to depend on the different needs of the people who are experiencing homelessness. But housing solves homelessness. And so we know that these Housing First programs work well, especially for chronically homeless people. The reason that we are so slow to adopt those programs is because you have to find a place to put it. And, you know, I don't need to tell you, you've probably paid attention. As soon as you make an announcement that you're looking at building some sort of facility where people who are experiencing homelessness are going to be located, community members lose their minds. And so it creates a real issue in terms of finding community support for locating Housing First facilities.
Well, what do other cities do? Well, again, we come back to the fact that the problem seems to be worse here than other cities. Is there some fundamental defect we have that they don't? Are they just hiding them better? I mean, what is it?
I think a lot of it has to do with the political will and the community support. You talked about the
This is a progressive area, right? There's no bluer area than people living in the shadow of the Space Needle, so we're told anyway, and it's all about progressive solutions to these social problems. So why is that so tough?
I think actually progressives, like, I'm not from Seattle. I've been here 8 years. I came from Chicago. In Chicago, people swing above the desk. Right. So meaning it's very clear what people are thinking from the get go. There's no sort of pretense about how liberal anybody is or how liberal anybody isn't. I actually think that the sort of progressive perspective that's or the presence, the persona that Seattle projects is even more dangerous. than just outright, stereotyping and discrimination, because people will say that they want to help people experiencing homelessness. They just don't want to have to give anything up in order to do it. And that doesn't make you progressive, to say that you want to help someone and then not to engage in the sort of self-reflection and say, gee, I wonder why that person is experiencing homelessness. Could it be something that just might not be their fault? And even if it was something that's not their fault, or if it was something that is quote unquote their fault, isn't there something that we could do to help address the underlying problem of homelessness? Mm-hmm. So I think that progressive personas without true compassion and without true reflection is Seattle's problem.
Like a progressive neighborhood that doesn't want to have a safe parking lot anywhere near them.
That is precisely.
Or they don't want to upzone some of those single family neighborhoods to make it easier to build cheaper apartments for people.
You're giving wonderful examples.
Yeah.
And there are so many, we could spend an entire hour just enumerating them.
Yeah. So in terms of the role of your group and the work at Seattle University, have you proposed specific projects which have run into this buzzsaw of progressive opposition?
Yes.
Yes. Well, give me a few examples.
Yes, we have.
We should talk in concrete terms here so people, you know, quit saying, do something about it when they, in fact, are the reason that nothing's been done about it.
Yes. So we've produced in the last 4 years, we've produced 16 reports. And many of them are look at laws that, like I said before, that create homelessness or make homelessness worse. And that each of those reports has specific recommendations about how those laws can be changed or repealed. And still address public safety and public health concerns, just in a way that doesn't contribute to homelessness. So there's a number of those sorts of reports that are critiquing laws. This year, what's new is we've been asked by our community partners to talk about specific innovative solutions to homelessness. A few examples. One, safe parking programs to deal with vehicle residency. Vehicle residency is one of our most pressing problems here in Seattle. Another report deals with authorized encampments. We've been experimenting with authorized encampments here in Seattle, so have a number of other cities. A third report looks at accessory dwelling units or sort of secondary dwelling units. You talked about zoning laws. We definitely need to make some changes in zoning laws to encourage that sort of building. And there are a number of programs throughout the country that are experimenting with creating incentives for people to build accessory dwelling units in residential backyards as a way of increasing affordable housing and addressing homelessness. There's also a report on how members of the faith community can deal with and provide support for homelessness on their property. So there's a number of innovative solutions that these reports look at, not just theoretically, but we actually look at case studies where this has been done mm-hmm. successfully across the country, and we synthesize recommendations from looking at those lessons.
So if all your advice was followed, how long would it take for the tents to disappear from the highway medians and, you know, under bridges?
Well, there's sort of mixing things there. One of the things that we haven't done a complete report on is affordable housing, right? What the city needs to do to increase its affordable housing stock. That's something that's very, very clear in the public debate about how that would happen. Housing First reports, all of those are out there already. We don't do reports that have already been done. We only write reports on issues that haven't been thoroughly analyzed before. So that solution, the increase of affordable housing, is something that has been addressed in multiple reports. So we haven't done those reports. Mm-hmm. We don't need to do those reports.
Well, we know that the way the city of Seattle addressed the housing supply was to prohibit microhousing, which might have helped. But for some reason, people thought, well, that was too much pressure for our neighborhoods. And so that was abandoned.
There's a wonderful website and a wonderful group called Seattle Tech for Housing. And it's the number four. And your listeners can Google that and see they've done a number of reports and have recommendations. It's just one of many places you can look for what the city needs to be doing differently in terms of zoning and building. Our reports look at specific and innovative solutions that haven't been addressed in other areas. And that's why I mentioned one specific contribution we make is to look at the laws. Think about solving homelessness as a two-handed problem. The right hand makes investments in supportive programs, right? Mm-hmm. And looks at innovative solutions. The left hand implements the law. What we always talk about when we talk about homelessness is what the right hand is doing, right? Looking at these building houses, looking at innovative solutions. All of that is important, but we don't talk about what the left hand is doing. And the reason that's a problem is because the law is undoing the progress that we make with the right hand. So one of the biggest contributions the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project makes is to try to push people to understand that two-handed approach.
Which laws have to change? Are you
going
to say that camping in parks should be allowed, that unlimited parking in neighborhoods should be allowed?
No, but that is a fear-mongering tactic where mm-hmm. people will take it, you know, all the way to the ends of the universe and say everything's going to go down, in a flaming ball of fury if any of these sort of solutions are approached. The recommendations that are made in the reports that we have that look at laws have a number of different proposals. And it's funny because we've got 16 reports. They're fairly detailed so that any policymaker, could read through them and understand a specific issue really well. I found that a lot of city officials just want it boiled down to something very simple. So I actually pulled together a 12 steps that cities can take to mitigate the criminalization of homelessness. And that handout is also available. It's 2 pages front mm-hmm. and back.
Give me a few examples.
I'll give you a terrific example. One is I think we could start revising our laws to account for ability to pay. So this is something that's been analyzed in so many different circles. Have you ever heard the phrase debtor's prison before?
Yes.
Okay. So debtor's prisons is another issue that's just been so overanalyzed that everyone should accept it as a truth, that it doesn't work. It serves no positive purpose to hit a poor person with a fine or fee they can't pay.
Right.
Because it's not going to deter them, especially in the context of homelessness.
Well, doesn't Norway fine people based on a percentage of income, for example? So if you're a millionaire and you're caught speeding, it can cost you thousands of dollars.
Right. And here in the United States, there's a number of different states that are revising the way that they approach those sort of fines and fees. They're called legal financial obligations or LFOs. And so there's a ton of work out about how to revise legal financial obligations so that you're not creating a bigger problem than existed before you assessed that fine or fee. Mm-hmm. So, the law is supposed to serve two things. You want to either punish people in a way that exacts some sort of retribution, right? That's what we reserve for really, truly criminal behavior. You know, things like murdering someone, right? That's retribution. But the law is also supposed to deter people from engaging in some sort of conduct we don't want them to do. In the circumstance of someone who's homeless or poor, hitting them with a fine or fee is not going to deter them from being homeless or poor. Mm-hmm. It's actually going to make them more likely to be and remain homeless and poor. So thinking, this is what I mean about the left hand and the right hand, understanding what each other is doing. When we drag poor people through the criminal justice system, we make them more resistant to recovery. We make them more likely to remain homeless, to be on the streets, to self-medicate, and to be incarcerated. And of course, that whole picture that I just painted means we've made the problem worse through the intervention.
Has there ever been a sit down between the business community and the city to try and create a solution where each of these parties can do what would help, what they do best in terms of the private real estate people being free to build more of this, build more housing in neighborhoods where they couldn't before, and the city revising the laws so that people aren't ground to dust by the system we've set up.
So I don't know that the business community is very up to speed on the what we need to do to revise the laws. Oftentimes, it's the business community that is part of the problem.
Right. They say, police, come here and get this person out of my doorway and do whatever it takes. But I think they would admit that if that approach is actually making it worse, all they want is to have it solved.
Right.
I think it's fair to say that's what they want. And I think they'd be quite receptive to somebody who knows what they're talking about saying, dragging somebody out of the doorway and slapping them with a $500 fine is just going to have them back because they're not going to disappear.
Right. It's readjusting our expectation of how to solve the problem. The way that we've been approaching it so far is we want someone out of our view immediately.
Yeah.
And if we can't see them, then the problem doesn't exist. I think if we could appreciate one thing about the problem that we're creating, our own complicity in creating homelessness and poverty, it boils down to that. That view that if someone is out of my view, the problem is solved. When in fact, because we engage the criminal justice system to pull them out of view, and we've got no place for that person to go, all of the collateral consequences mean not just that that person will be back, but that person will be back and more resistant to recovering. So as long as all we're doing is sweeping things under the rug, eventually the rug gets so full of stuff that it's going to start coming out the other side. So we've got to figure out a way to stop this very costly rotating door. And revising our laws is a big step in that direction.
What people listening want to know is, okay, Sarah has said it is hypocritical to say you want a solution, but you don't want to give up anything. And it's that give up something that really worries people. So if homeless housing or housing for formerly homeless people came to my neighborhood, what would that look like? What would I be giving up? What could I expect to see?
I think a huge solution to all of this is proximity. I think that when people really want to think, how can I figure out what the solution to homelessness should be? The answer there is to get involved. To go out and meet some of the incredible men, women, and children who are struggling with this monumental burden of homelessness. And that is, there's a number of ways people can do that. Mary's Place, I mentioned Mary's Place earlier, has a phenomenal volunteer program. They'll virtually allow you to do anything you want that seems useful to you. You can, you know, bake cookies, you can read to kids, you can hang out with families. There's a variety of different ways. If people have the courage to volunteer and to get to know people, you know, that proximity is proven to make a difference. It's why in civil rights movements, and I do see this as a problem of discrimination and stereotyping. I really do. We know that segregation, it creates the problem. And so it's really by integrating people, creating closer connections with people who are dealing with these issues, that I think that Seattle can be transformed.
I finally met the guy who lives in the camper up by my parking space just up the hill out there. You know, he was out taking a smoke or something. Anyway, so I said, you know, hello, how are you, what are you doing? And he seemed like a perfectly nice fellow who explained a disability, and that's why he couldn't get a job. I said, I noticed the tickets on your camper there. What are you going to do? I said, I'm just going to move it over to that block for the next week, and then I'll move it back here. And I actually felt pretty reassured by the encounter, and it occurred to me if he had sort of a little bio posted on his door, here's why I'm here, here's where I came from, here's why I'm living here, even something like that might assure people, oh, this is not some crackhead who's waiting to break into my car. This is just somebody who needs a place to live and hasn't got any other place to go.
Right, but the burden shouldn't be on him to produce a bio, right, that he puts on the outside of his car.
Yeah.
What you're talking about, though, is exactly the point, which is stopping and getting to know people. I mentioned Mary's Place. Another really great program is Facing Homelessness. Rex Holbein has a opportunities for people to make connections with people experiencing homelessness in really meaningful ways so that you can develop relationships with people. And that program does exactly what you were just just suggesting, Dave. It has pictures of people experiencing homelessness, stories of people experiencing homelessness. So there's ways that people can do that. But as long as you're looking at a piece of paper or the computer, you're still not gaining that proximity.
Yeah.
It really is about finding a program in your neighborhood that serves people experiencing homelessness and putting yourself out there, having the courage to be part of the solution that I think will make the difference.
Okay, but I don't want this to dissolve into, you know, sort of kumbaya and everything will be fine if we just get to know each other. Because I think if it does not ultimately lead to getting the tents off the street, not just to get them out of sight, but because they're no longer needed.
To get them into housing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, is there any solution you see that removes the tents from the street because there are now finally better places for people who are poor to live?
Housing first. You know, I'll go back to housing first and affordable housing. Obviously, we have to have the housing for people to move into. But the way you get that, this is sort of a circle, right? We keep talking about how all these things are connected. The more people that have the courage to connect, the more likely those people will be to support innovative solutions that are being proposed. The problem is us. We know what the solutions are. It's just that we as a community really don't want to be part of the solution. We want the solution to happen. That's what makes us look progressive, is yeah. We'll say that we want these things to happen. We don't want to have to give anything up. We don't want to have to put any skin in the game in order to come up with a solution. And, you know, you said kumbaya. For people who are not persuaded, you know, sort of by the humanity of the men, women, and children who are enduring homelessness, you have to be persuaded by the fiscal impacts, you know, so that can't get lost in this discussion. Is we're talking about the way that we approach it now is the least effective and the most expensive way to deal with the problem. So if we want to have solutions that are cost effective, solutions that address the problem, we're all going to have to get behind it. And that can have not just compassionate results, but it will have good fiscal results as well.
So are you saying that your solution might mean that Seattle doesn't need a head tax, doesn't need to increase its homelessness budget, because that budget represents the inflated price of trying to solve it the wrong way?
I think because the left hand and the right hand are not working together, we are wasting money in many ways. So the right hand is the hand that does all the innovative solutions. I still don't think we have a coherent plan for how to pull all of that together. But I think the biggest problem is not, you know, sort of the lack of coherence of what the right hand is doing. It's that it doesn't matter how much money you put into the right hand, the left hand is taking it out. Through the punitive laws that we're using, mm-hmm. and creating that costly rotating door that is going to send
people
right
back into
the pile.
That's why it gets more and more expensive, because we're funding solutions that are being undone by the law enforcement that we are also funding.
That's right.
And so they both get more expensive because they're both fighting each other.
Yes.
Well, that's crazy.
Can I quote you? That's crazy.
Well, it's like the same taxpayers are fighting both sides of a proxy war here, and that would mean that costs would escalate with no limit, with no end in sight.
I don't think we can solve our homelessness problem if we're not looking at the way that our laws punish people experiencing homelessness. So if we can get the left hand working better, the way that we spend our money will become more effective. Mm. And I need to make two other points, if
Go
I
ahead.
May. Something that a lot of folks don't understand is the role of racism in homelessness. People of color, immigrants, single female-headed families, people with physical or mental disabilities are all disproportionately represented in poor and homeless populations when compared to the general population. There's a reason, right? I mean, that there's a reason for that. It's not because all of those different groups are suffering some sort of fatal flaw that makes them more prone to poverty and homelessness. It's because the way that our laws operate and because of systemic discrimination, that feeds into the problem of poverty and homelessness. If you look at, for example, white Americans, we represent about 73% of the national population, but only 28% of the national homeless population. Mm-hmm. Black Americans represent about 13% of the national population, but over 40% of the homeless population. Native Americans, Native Alaskans are 8 times more likely to be homeless than someone who's not. There was a study that just came out recently that showed that black youth under the age of 5 are 29 times more likely to be in a homeless shelter than white youth. It has to be part of the solution to all of this has to be recognizing, like I said, in terms of the way the laws work, it's part of a system that is designed to produce poverty and homelessness. So it's going to require some really deep changes in the way that we think about how our laws create these problems in the first place and what we can do to stop it.
So now you're saying we can't solve homelessness until we've fixed racism?
I'm saying, well, that is true. I think if you're really talking about the perfect solution, right, the nirvana of homelessness being fixed. But what's interesting is we have gotten to a point where we can talk about racism in some ways. If you think about the changes that have been made since, you know, say the 1940s to now, it's not uncommon for someone to be able to, to recognize that racism is wrong, right? We can say that publicly. But a lot of people don't understand that when you're talking about homelessness, if you've ever seen an article and you look at the comments underneath an article about homelessness and you look at the comments underneath, I would invite you to change the word homeless to some sort of reference to a person of color. The world would be on fire, right? I mean, people would lose their minds because it's not appropriate to talk about people the way that we talk about homeless people. So we've made evolutions. We can think about what it means, what discrimination means, the problem with discrimination. We've made huge progress in terms of our thinking about it. We haven't fixed it, that is for sure. But we've made a lot of progress in terms of thinking about the way that discrimination creates problems like lack of economic mobility, obstacles to housing. We need to start thinking about that more broadly with respect to homelessness because all of those marginalized groups are so disproportionately represented in homeless populations.
Okay, just to bring us back to the world of the concrete, if we follow these suggestions, I don't think we can solve racism anytime soon.
That's true.
But if we followed your suggestions on just the practical changes that could be made in the law, if we followed your suggestions on the practical changes that could be made in the law and in the types of services we offer, are we talking about 1 year, 5 years, 15 years before we see the tents and campers disappear?
I think if all of the recommendations in all 16 of our reports were followed, you get the left hand to synchronize with what the right hand is doing, and we brought housing first to scale, I think you wouldn't even recognize the city. I think that the city would look like an entirely different place, and all for the better.
Sarah Rankin is a law professor at CLU and with the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project. Sarah, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.
Okay, we're going to add this on because I just found out that Sarah was at the Ballard meeting on the head tax. You were at this big town hall held in Ballard about the head tax, where it was like a rebellion. It's still echoing. It seems to be the first time the city council became aware of how deeply upset people were with the failure to get the tents and campers off the street. Now, you had a visceral reaction to that. You found that to be just over the top.
I think the way I would describe it would be terrifying.
You found it terrifying.
I found it terrifying.
Just the level of anger from people who live in the area.
The level of anger, you know, Erica Barnett has a blog called C is for Crank, and she did sort of a blow-by-blow that I thought was such a good representation of what was going on. I mean, you could literally see spit flying out of people's mouths. There was so much anger. That sort of anger only comes from people who feel threatened. And people who feel confused. And that's part of the problem with homelessness, generally speaking, is there's so many different discussions about what to do. There's so much fear about whether I might wake up homeless, you know, one day, or whether something like that might happen to me. It confuses people, and it angers people. So what I saw, it was primitive, I guess, is the best way I could describe it.
So if you'd been on the panel that night with the city council members, what would you tell those people?
I think you have to the one good thing about it was it gave people an opportunity to vent. I think people have to have an opportunity to vent, so that you can clear the slate and then, you know, talk to them. I do think, and I'm married to an Amazonian, mm-hmm. which you know makes me, I suppose, a study in irony, but I do think that Amazon and other businesses that you know are taking up a lot of the downtown area, dragging a lot of employees into Seattle, are contributing to the affordable housing crisis. I believe that that's true, and I also believe that that it's fair. I think that the head tax is fair in my view. I think it's fair. I think it's fair to ask businesses that are contributing to the affordable housing crisis to take ownership. What I would have loved to have seen from Amazon is not waiting for the head tax to have to be imposed. Amazon does not do a particularly good job of advertising the good stuff that it does do. You know, it never really put out a whole bunch of advertising about the Mary's Place, facilities that it supports. It could have done something like Cisco did in Santa Clara. Cisco, I don't remember the order of it, but it was something like $20, maybe $60 million. It was double digits, millions of dollars that Cisco pledged to support a specific group that was addressing homelessness in Santa Clara. Wonderful response from the community. So it got out ahead of it and said, mm-hmm. you know what, we understand that we're contributing to the tight housing market. We want to be a player. I was saying earlier, listeners want to think about how to get skin in the game. So do businesses. Businesses need to think about how to get skin in the game. And so I don't think that the head tax is a bad idea. But it all does. I also understand people who oppose it because it's not 100% clear how the money is going to be used.
Well,
so the city needs
out.
To be.
I mean, if you're going to support the head tax at the same time you say the city is using money across purposes because it hasn't reformed enforcement, that would be a waste.
It certainly would make it less effective, right? So that's where I sit on it. It's not that I think that the head tax is a bad idea. I think we do need more money to address the problem of affordable housing and homelessness. We absolutely do. And the city has many good ideas about how to spend that money. But it's sort of like, sticking your hand in a bowl and just sort of groping around. There's stuff in that bowl that might be, you know, really wonderful, but we don't have a coordinated vision for how all of this stuff is going to come together. So I think the head tax, what the city could do, to do a better job here is to communicate more clearly about what the head tax money will be used for, to be more clear about what the money that is all allocated to address affordable housing and homelessness is doing as part of a coordinated, coherent vision, and make sure that you're addressing what the left hand is doing. And that is where, as I said at the beginning,
the left hand being law enforcement.